This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us here as we get ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
We're going to start the show today with Iran. U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal with Iran earlier this year, and now he's taking real action to punish this terrorist-sponsoring nation. For this story, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent.
So the first of the financial sanctions on Iran came into effect early Tuesday morning at 12:01 a.m., these are sanctions that the United States has put on the car manufacturing sector, as well as the purchase of commercial aircraft and some other things, and really trying to tighten the financial pressure on Iran to try and convince them to stop a lot of their actions, most of their actions across the Middle East. This isn't about any of the nuclear program right now. The United States is trying to stop their funding of terrorism, trying to stop their adventurism across the Middle East. The United States now sees Iran as being the central cause of the Middle East upset, as well as their quest for nuclear weapons. And so they're kind of jumping back, it seems, back to 2008, 2009, or 2008, when Iran was under U.S. financial sanctions, to try and bring them to the negotiating table. The attempt is, again, that Iran, we are going to tighten the screws in your economy until you moderate yourselves.
The big story here, I guess you've written an article on the website, United States Imposes Sanctions on Iran, in the second half of that title, and Europe's dismaying response. The United States doesn't seem to be getting cooperation from Europe on this.
Well, yeah, what's different between these sanctions and the sanctions that were put on back a decade ago is the fact that the Europeans were on board. But this isn't the case right now. The Europeans want to continue with the nuclear deal. They want to continue their business transactions with Iran. And so they have actually enacted a separate law, a law that came up back in 1996 called a blocking law, which actually bars EU companies from pulling out of the Iranian Iran with their business deals due to the pressure from the United States without getting first express approval from the European Commission. And if they do so, they're going to be penalized by their governments. And so they're basically enacting a law to stop the sanctions from taking effect as far as what European companies do. And this is quite stunning. This is quite stunning that you would create a law and enact it to stop what the United States is trying to achieve in moderating Iran. Europe sees it as this in the sense that we like the nuclear deal. We feel like this has been good. Iran hasn't gone and created a bomb under the nuclear deal. So let's keep on incentivizing them to stay in the nuclear deal by giving them the business contracts.
There's two aspects of this that I find pretty fascinating. One is just the fact that Europe is so committed to this deal, in spite of all of the evidence showing that Iran was not acting in good faith, that it was deceiving the international community in many ways, as we saw in that huge trove of documents that Benjamin Netanyahu presented to the world. The fact that the European leaders would insist, no, this is the best way forward. What do you make of that, first of all?
You know, that is a quandary that I can't really get to get a grip on. Even this week, we had a number of articles that came out talking about how Iran official members of Iran's government were trying to conduct terrorist attacks inside Europe over the past couple of years. This report came out. And then at the same time, here is Europe trying to stay in the nuclear deal. And Europe knows where the money goes. As soon as the US, enacted this U.S. and other countries had the nuclear deal signed or whenever it started, and Iran got the $150 billion as well as other business contracts. We know where that money went. We know where how a third of it didn't go. A third of it went to the IRGC and its military. It didn't go to the people. And that's what the Europeans are saying. Europeans are saying, well, how can the United States do this? The Iranian economy is already in shambles and the people are hurting. And indeed they are. But the money that Iran is getting is not going to the people. That's the problem. So I can't understand the rationale of the Europeans, apart from the fact that they like to separate themselves from the United States and the United States President Donald Trump. If he's doing it, it seems we're not going to have a part of it. We are going to do something different. And as I bring out in that short article, this is exacerbating this rift between the United States and its European allies, its longtime European allies. And that's probably more damaging than anything from this law. There's a ways around for European companies. There's ways to pull out of Iran and not really be affected by this law. They could probably prove that they're not pulling out because the United States sanctions that it is. Iran's a failing economy anyway, so we're getting our company out. And so they might not be affected by the European law. What the effect on the ground is because of this law is it just puts huge daylight between the U.S. and Europe.
Well, that really is, I guess, the second big takeaway from this is just how much that exacerbates this rift that we've seen developing between the United States and Europe. And the fact that European leaders would be willing to take this action really in defiance against what the U.S. president is trying to do is quite extraordinary. Andrew, you had a comment.
Yeah, I'd say my facts are right. I also believe that most European nations, especially Germany, have a lot deeper financial and economic ties to Iran than the United States does. So for us to sanction Iran, it helps crack down on terrorism, and it doesn't really touch our economy at all. Well, for Germany to sanction Iran, it may help cut down on terrorism, but they're going to take a little bit more of a hit. So it's kind of a similar reason why the Germans aren't thrilled with sanctions on Russia, is that their economy is very tied to Russia's, where America's is not.
Well, we do appreciate that, Brent. I would encourage anyone to go online to thetrumpet.com, check out this article by Brent Noctegal, United States Imposes Sanctions on Iran and Europe's Dismaying Response. You can get that right there on the front page of thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that. A lot of interesting discussion going on lately regarding the German military. To learn about these, we will go now to Richard Palmer.
Yes, a couple of very interesting topics under discussion. The first that we'll talk about is conscription. Germany ended conscription in 2011. The German defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, wanted to move the German military away from this kind of, you know, Soviet focus of we want an army to throw up as much cannon fodder in the way of a Russian invasion as possible, to something that was much leaner, more professional, and that could just deploy quickly around the world. So he cancelled conscription, focusing Germany on becoming a much more professional military. Since then, they've had a problem. It's a problem we've talked about before on this show. It's recruiting people, persuading people to join the army. They haven't had enough jobs to fill all the jobs they want. So now we've kind of come back around full circle to talk about conscription again, that maybe we'll use conscription to try and fill these jobs. That's part of the thinking behind conscription. The other thinking is social cohesion. You know, you've got a lot of talk about a divided society right now, especially with all of these Muslim immigrants. You've had, especially with a few things that went on during the World Cup, you're now having a lot of talk about, well, how German are, say, German Turkish citizens, Turks that were born in Germany, but you know, where do they have all their loyalty? And so people are thinking about conscription as a way to unite the country as well and to create some kind of united purpose. Because most people that get conscripted, quote unquote, in Germany don't actually serve in the army, or didn't back when they had it. They would do a kind of citizenship service instead, where they would just do community service things. So for these two pressures, they're talking about conscription. Now, important members of the German coalition party still seem to be against it. Zu Guttenberg has come and he's spoken out against it as well, said that that it's not an efficient use of money. So it doesn't look like it's going anywhere right now. But the fact that Germany's thinking along the lines of our army is too small, we need to find a way to fill these jobs. We talked a couple of weeks ago about how they were talking about inviting citizens from other EU countries to join the German army. They're looking for ways to beef up their military. Conscription may not be the solution that they go with, but that's what they're looking for right now.
Okay, so that's one aspect of discussion that we're hearing about in Germany. Another regards nuclear weapons.
That's right. It was on the front page of the Welt am Sonntag on July 29th. Do we need the bomb? And this was a question from one of Germany's top foreign policy thinkers. And really, this is a question that has just kept coming up since Donald Trump became president. I mean, you start to make account of all of the newspapers that have either said Germany needs to get the bomb or we need to have some kind of a discussion about getting the bomb. And it's quite broad. You've got the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung has done that, Spiegel Online, Tagesspiegel, the public television channel, ARD. So this, for the last couple of years, has been a big point of discussion in Germany. Just like the conscription, I don't think it's going anywhere in the immediate future in terms of Germany itself having a nuclear weapons program. There's no support for a public nuclear weapons program. There's no support for that within the current German government that we see right now. But firstly, like Brent was talking about, you see the break with America. By publicly saying we need a nuclear weapon, you're saying we don't trust America to defend Germany. We don't trust America to stop a nuclear war. We need to look for ourselves. And then also, the general consensus is that if Germany goes down this route, they'll put it in European clothing just to try and make it a little bit less objectionable. Having said that, even Poland, last year, one of their top leaders came out and said, we're fine with Germany getting the nuclear bomb. In fact, we wish they would, because we want them to help defend us. But I think just to kind of sell it to the German people as well as to sell it abroad, they probably clothe it as a European bomb rather than a German one.
So a couple of items here where we're talking about discussion taking place within Germany. How serious do we need to take this, Richard?
Well, these are pretty big discussions for Germany to be having. I mean, this is a country that, especially to be talking about having a nuclear bomb, you look at how much Germany has changed. It wasn't long ago where actually getting rid of the American nuclear bombs that are within Germany, that was kind of on the political table. And that was a lot of Germany's top political parties were saying, yes, we need to send back America's nuclear bombs that are in Germany. We don't want them. That is completely gone from the agenda now. They're staying within Germany. And now we've kind of come so far away from that Germany is saying, we need to think about getting our own bomb. And then you look at just all the discussions about the military and you put that in context with the other discussions, like we mentioned, about the EU, about recruiting EU soldiers. This is a pretty big shift for Germany. For Germany to be talking about, we need to be a stronger military power and we need to think about getting the bomb. Yes, it's just talk, but it's talk that indicates a fundamental shift in Germany. I think we may have to wait until we have a bold leader before that talk gets translated into action. I don't know whether Angela Merkel is going to be the one to implement any of this. But the fact that this talk is going on shows that there's a pretty big appetite within Germany for change in the role that Germany plays in the world. And it's that change in Germany's role that we talk a lot about at The Trumpet and at this website. Our free book, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, will give you a great overview of what the Bible says about Germany. And the Bible has a lot of very specific prophecies about Germany's role, about Germany getting militarily involved in the Middle East, about some very... Daniel chapter 11 talks about the king of the north at the time of the end, and the king of the north is referring to Germany. We can prove that in our material. But it talks about them launching a whirlwind-style attack with many chariots and many ships and... just a very rapid attack. That requires a military to back it up. some of the language in there, well, there's other language in the Bible that talks about, I mean, we talked about this on Wednesday's program, nuclear bombs being used. So this is the direction that we know from Bible prophecy that Germany is going to go in, and you start to see an appetite now for Germany to go in that direction. So our free book, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, will help you see what the Bible says about where Germany is going. And so you can see how what we're seeing in Germany right now slots right in with those long-term forecasts.
This week marked 10 years since Russia invaded Georgia. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury called that the beginning of a dangerous new era. And the decade since has proven that assessment to be correct. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, 10 years ago today, Russia was still in the middle of that landmark five-day war with the tiny former Soviet nation of Georgia right there on its southern border. That conflict lasted from August 7th to August 12th of 2008. And, the Russian military quickly overcame all Georgian resistance. They ended up pushing Georgian forces out of two regions, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And Putin ended up asserting control over those regions, which together make up about a fifth of Georgia's internationally recognized territory. And as you said, on Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury's radar, that was just a very pivotal geopolitical event. He said that was the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. And looking back on it now, with the benefit of hindsight, we can see that he was exactly right about that. Even if we just look at what's happened inside of Georgia in the 10 years since then, one of the most disturbing aspects of Georgia's ongoing occupation there has been what you might call its creeping expansion or creeping annexation deeper and deeper into Georgia's territory. The Heritage Foundation has been monitoring this, and they found that in the 10 years since the initial invasion, Russia has engaged in 56 incidents of what they call borderization. And in many of these instances of borderization, Russian forces, along with separatist forces, move their border southward into the Georgia-controlled territory. So it's often just a few yards at a time, but little by little, they're expanding the size of the area that Russia controls. So it's a really bizarre situation. Sometimes a Georgian individual will go to sleep in free Georgia and wake up the next morning in occupied Georgia because the fences have been moved while he was asleep that night. In some cases, farmers have been divided from their crops by this ever-moving border fence. Villages have been divided right down the middle in some situations. In the most significant of these cases, the border was moved about a mile all at once, and with that move, a major oil pipeline operated by BP was suddenly in the Georgia-controlled area. So the Heritage Foundation says that Russia's gradual expansion there represents, quote, an egregious attack on Georgia's sovereignty and territorial integrity. And there's no indication that this egregious attack will come to an end anytime soon. So 10 years on, it is clear that 2008 invasion was the start of a dangerous era, just as Mr. Fleury had said it was.
You know, on the show on Wednesday, Richard did a report about nuclear proliferation and how much activity there is in so many nations. We were just talking about Germany, the discussion within Germany about procuring nuclear weapons, but this is happening elsewhere too, even within Asia. The question emerged, just how much has Vladimir Putin personally been responsible for the increase in military spending and arms race, all of the activity that Russia has been engaged in over these past 10 years. Gerald Fleury has been talking, well, even before that, when Putin came into office in 2004, about how much his rise within Russia has been creating this sense of fear, and even in Eastern European nations, perhaps even panic about how to resist what's going on there.
Yes, Vladimir Putin clearly has an expansionistic, aggressive foreign policy, and the nations of Europe are definitely taking note. That 2004 article that Mr. Fleury wrote was, I think it was about some election fraud that Putin had authored with some parliamentary elections that ended up securing his tenure well after that point. And the title of that was Russia. Russian elections frightens Europe.
Yeah.
And fulfills Bible prophecy. Yeah. So he's really drawing a clear connection between, you know, European fear of Russia is causing Europeans to unite and militarize. So Putin has been a huge catalyst just in the kind of the global arms race that we see happening.
And you're drawing attention to the 10-year anniversary of the Georgia invasion. He's done similar types of adventurism since then.
Right. Yeah, just after Russia's invasion of Georgia, Mr. Flurry said that Russia's aggression would not stay limited to Georgia. In our October 2008 issue, he said this was the first strike of a rising Asian superpower. There will be more. Will a crisis occur over Ukraine? Surely Russia is willing to wage war over that as well. And then, you know, of course, 5.5 years later, in March 2014, that was proven right. That's when Russia invaded Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula and annexed it to Russia. And then we've also seen Putin use military power to kind of keep eastern Ukraine in a state of frozen conflict there, kind of clandestinely and furtively. But he's also kept Georgia and Ukraine and other former Soviet nations from developing closer ties to Europe. He's been busy modernizing the Russian military. He ousted America from Kyrgyzstan, where we had a base there for, it was actually our last base in Central Europe. And of course, he's now deeply engaged in the Middle East, where he's sidelining America. He's helping the brutal Syrian regime to stay in power. He's helping Iran basically continue its pursuit of nuclear weapons. There's even evidence now that Putin is kind of working with Germany to have greater control over Eastern European nations. So he's all over the place, really, especially in his periphery, but even beyond into the Middle East. And all of these things show that Russia's invasion of Georgia 10 years ago really did mark the start of something new. It really was the beginning of a dangerous new era, just as Mr. Flurry said.
Well, thank you very much for that. You can go back to that article from Mr. Flurry in 2008, Russia's attack signals dangerous new era. And also, Jeremiah has an article on this very subject, 10 years after Russia invaded Georgia. It keeps taking more territory. That's available on the front page of thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. This week in America, we got a reminder of just how powerful social media and technology companies have grown in shaping public discourse, raising questions about the state of free speech in America. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this week started off on Sunday and spreading into Monday with five big tech and social media companies, Apple, Facebook, Google, Pinterest, and Spotify, all clamping down and removing content from the firebrand internet radio host Alex Jones. The representatives from both Apple and Facebook came out and said that Jones's content violated their hate speech policies. And they were removing the Alex Jones channel and several InfoWars boards from their social media platforms. This has gotten a lot of media attention just because Jones's views are so controversial and in many cases erroneous, but it does raise the debate over whether or not he has a right to express them on the internet and in the public sphere. These are all private companies, which technically do have the constitutional right to deny him a platform for not adhering to their company policies.
Yeah.
But it was also kind of strange that all five of these companies decided in the same 24-hour period that they were going to crack down on this content. There would have had to have been at least some discussion between the management on these companies that decided that they were going to do this together.
Yeah.
And Democratic Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut came out right after that, praising these tech giants' banning of Jones InfoWars as a good start, but then saying that they needed to go further at banning other sites like Jones because the survival of our democracy is at stake. In particular, he said, InfoWars is the tip of an iceberg of hate and lies that uses sites like Facebook and YouTube to tear apart our nation. These companies must do more to take down one site, the survival of our democracy depends on it. That's a little more controversial in that this is a member of Congress telling private companies that they need to save American democracy by taking this content off their website. So that's now you're getting a government official talking about censorship, which when government forces you to do that, that's definitely a violation of the First Amendment. Now, when you look at the five biggest tech companies in Silicon Valley, I mean, together they put about $50 million into lobbyist fees in Washington, D.C. So as much as some of those like Senator Bernie Sanders complain about the Wall Street bankers buying government favors, Silicon Valley outspends Wall Street 2-1. Mm. There's more
alignment, I guess, between Silicon Valley and Washington than what people are saying. Well, this is just private companies; they can choose to do this. But you're saying that there's more alignment between those two than would meet the eye.
Well, yeah, that $50 million isn't a free will political donation you give out of the goodness of your heart. That's something that you spend in return for political favors. I mean, that's what a lobbyist does. You're actually wanting, you're donating money for people to lobby on your behalf for the government to pass laws that are favorable to your business, or in many cases help your business keep other businesses from challenging your market share. It's one of the reasons that these companies like Apple and Google are bigger than most nations, in terms of their revenue stream. And they dominate the marketplace of idea and the internet to an extent that even though they're private companies, when you're banned from them, it does become difficult to get a public platform.
Right.
And you're looking like a nation like Iran or Russia or China, the government just comes out and says these ideas are banned. In America, because of First Amendment, Congress can't do that. If the government wanted to ban an idea, you'd have to do it in like a quid pro quo type way. They're like, well, we're passing these laws that help keep other companies from challenging your marketplace, and now you need to do like Senator Chris Murphy says and make sure that people have controversial ideas that are tearing America apart don't get a voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Richard.
Yeah, I think Andrew makes a really good point. I think if you look at InfoWars, I think you can make a pretty good case that he should be pushed off a lot of these platforms. I mean, if you look, the United States is at war. It's at war in the Middle East. It's at war still in Afghanistan. And for someone like Alex Jones to come out and spread, you know, 9/11 was an inside job type conspiracy theory, I mean, that's treason to be spreading those kinds of lies. The way that he unquestionably spreads Russian propaganda that comes straight from Vladimir Putin, an enemy of the U.S., you know, just unquestionably spreading things that come from Russian government-run news sites. Again, cooperating with an enemy of the state, that's treason. And so, you know, if you look at, say, you know, Britain during World War II, if somebody wanted to go on air and say, actually, Britain is at fault here and Adolf Hitler's not so bad, that wouldn't be allowed. So, yeah, you look at just this one case and it seems quite justifiable. But then you look at, well, who's making those decisions? And like Andrew said, it's these tech companies. It's not a government decision. It's tech companies that have this very strong left-wing bias. And so, okay, maybe you happen to agree or disagree with their decision in this particular case, but look at that power that they've got. And am I going to be sitting here agreeing with their decision the next time it happens?
Right.
Maybe I will, maybe I won't be. But then how do you fix it? Because then, well, what do you do? The only way to stop them deciding is to start bringing the government involved. And then now we're like communist China, and in some ways that's even worse. So it's a really tough predicament, but it does show the power that is in some of these very left-leaning companies.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. What is the precedent that has been set here? And you know, I wrote a trumpet brief about this on Wednesday, and just it did definitely make my mind go to the passage in Amos 7 and in Amos 8 where it says there is coming a point where the land cannot bear all his words, and there's a concerted effort. It appears to be a certain amount of public pressure combined with political might to silence and squelch and expunge God's message from being able to be publicized within the United States. And then it specifically talks about a famine of the word resulting from that whole incident in Amos 7. So it is, I mean, we're talking about the ability to reach new people on some of these platforms. There's nothing, I mean, Alex Jones is still free to put whatever he wants on the internet on his own platforms. But it is remarkable just how much power these companies have come to assume. We've really empowered them by, you know, investing so much in these kinds of platforms and their ability to reach people with the message. So it is quite interesting to see how this unfolded within this one case and what kind of precedent that might set for us in the years ahead or the months ahead. We appreciate that. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll talk about renewed open conflict between Israel and Hamas, Vladimir Putin's latest move recalling the Soviet era, Turkey's strongman leader still getting the royal treatment from other countries despite the dictatorial powers he's taking to himself, and more stories than that. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
There's been a lot of talk recently about a truce between Israel and the terrorist group Hamas. There's a lot of reason to be skeptical about this. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so all through the beginning of this week, I probably printed off maybe, I don't know, 6, 7, or 8 articles talking about this astounding truce that was imminent between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. This was going to be a long-term truce, 5 to 10 years, where eventually the so-called siege would be lifted almost completely, where goods would be able to flow into Gaza through a port, and then the different crossings into Egypt and Israel would be opened up, and so on and so forth. That was what everybody was talking about until Wednesday night, Thursday morning, when we saw, even amidst this talk, a massive attack from Hamas against Israel. Over 200 mortars and rockets were fired into Israel, into the south of Israel, one of those reaching as far as Beersheba, 40 kilometers. We haven't seen this since 2014. That was a grad rocket that just struck just outside Beersheba. And so it kind of, I mean, Israel, especially those who are in the south, were kind of in shock by this, because of this intense, because of the talk of peace, and at the same time, Hamas was ready to turn around the next day and unleash just a rocket shower on the south of Israel.
What precipitated the ceasefire talks, or how much hope was there in that? I know there's been a lot of criticism of the Israeli government for even trying to do that. Don't these events vindicate that criticism?
They definitely do. Right now in the South, there's a lot of people upset because we've had this for the last year. We've had on again, off again war. People having to run to their, you know, 15, 20 seconds running to their bomb shelters in the middle of the night, snatching up your children. There was one report where this woman, she was describing that she's got 5 kids and she had to pick which 2 she would take to the bomb shelter. And this is the type of situation those in the southern areas of Israel have been under for the past year. And even though they're under that, the Israeli government is saying, well, we're actually negotiating a truce here with Hamas, something that Israel has not done ever. They haven't negotiated truces with Hamas because Hamas is a terrorist organization and they've refused to do that. And now, lo and behold, through the Egyptians mediating, Israel is willing to have some type of truce with Hamas before they even accept, you know, the prerequisites of any type of deal making, which were, one of them, recognize the state of Israel. Israel has said, we will not negotiate with Hamas until they recognize us. Well, Hamas hasn't done that. and yet Israel's negotiating. So you see a divergence between the public, especially in the south of Israel, and the Israeli government. The people in the south can't understand why Israel just doesn't go and flatten much of the Hamas run Gaza Strip because of the war, the barrage that they're under completely. I think it's very interesting. This change of tactics is similar to what we've seen under Mr. Trump in a way, throwing out some type of hand to the terrorists, whether it be even what he said last week about Iran. I'm really willing to negotiate with you anytime, anywhere. North Korea, we can do all this, you know, have all this rhetoric, but we'll negotiate with you. Israel's kind of doing the same thing with Hamas right now. Even as Hamas is throwing down the gauntlet, really, or just poking Israel in the eye, basically, as they're trying to negotiate some type of deal. This is shocking to me, but in a way, it's not surprising. This type of truce-making, deal-making is something that we've been watching for at the Trumpet for some time. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, has written about this in Jerusalem and Prophecy, a book that was written and has been updated, but originally written in the early 90s, at the time that, and into the 2000s, at the time that Israel was giving up key strategic areas in order to gain peace. And he said this wouldn't work. I've just got a quote from page 14 of that booklet. He said, "So little trust in God, so much trust in their enemies. This real wound is spiritual, a lack of faith in God. The Jews keep trying to heal themselves by making peace pacts, be it with Fatah and the Oslo Accords, back in the early 90s into 2000, or now it looks Hamas. We're trying to heal themselves by peace pacts. When they were strong," he writes, "they trusted God. Recent history proves this. A few years ago, they were a terror to the Arabs. Now the Arabs are a terror to the Jews." The Arabs right now, even though Israel could just wipe out Hamas overnight if it wanted to, right now the Arabs are a terror to the Jews. Talk to anyone in southern Israel. I read another story about another man that he's serving on a base there in southern Israel, and his first night on the base, he's got to run for cover. And while he's there in his little in the bunker, he's thinking about the tens of thousands of other Israelis that are having to do that, families, the very same time that he's having to do that as a soldier. And he said, "For the first time, I didn't understand why we don't go in there 100-fold and just fix the problem." Israel, a long time ago, probably would have done that, but not anymore.
Yeah, Richard.
The thing that really just drove home to me just this morning, the scale of what's happening in Israel. I just saw an article in the Jerusalem Post. The headline is, "Which rocket siren app is best?"
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's just kind of like, you know, like we're in the West, we're like, well, what's the best, I don't know, like online shopping app or shoe finding app? And in Israel, the question is, you got to run from the cover in the middle of the night. Which is the best app to alert you to what's going on?
Yeah, and even on that point, Hamas is into their hacking into these apps right now, and they've just created a fake app that Israelis have been downloading, which turns their phones basically as a spy weapon for Hamas, because Israelis have to download the Code Red apps, and so they've even infiltrated that area as well.
The susceptibility of the Israeli government, even under Netanyahu's rulership, to want to make these kinds of deals, and as you said, there seems to be a certain amount of kind of willing to take whatever course might be available, maybe even something that would be unorthodox. That I don't know if desperation is quite the word for it, but it definitely does point you back to those prophecies you talked about, wound, that of course being a reference to the prophecy in Hosea 5 and verse 13 that specifically describes Judah's wound, a prophecy that Gerald Flory has gone back to time and time again. And in some periods in Israel's history, it seems like they've definitely moved away from that kind of thinking. But I guess we're seeing that still there at play in the way that Israel is conducting itself here. We'll have to keep our eyes on it. We certainly appreciate you bringing that to us, Brent. Moving on, Vladimir Putin has been doing his best to restore Russia to its Soviet-era glory, doing quite a good job of it. And in doing so, he's made several moves that recall Soviet policies, including one this week that we'll learn about from Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was a presidential decree that Russian President Vladimir Putin just made, and it went mostly unnoticed by Western media, but it was actually a pretty significant step. He established a new political wing within the Russian army that is intended to promote patriotism and loyalty in soldiers during a time of rising tensions with the West. Alexander Kanchin of the Russian Ministry of Defense talked about this new wing. And he said, quote, "The role of political unity in the army is increasing immensely at this time of global confrontation. Therefore, it is necessary to significantly strengthen the armed forces' entire political structure. This new wing will be responsible for the moral and ideological aspect of the Russian army." So right now it's limited to just the army. It'll basically weed out all dissent and promote, it really sounds to me like blind loyalty among soldiers. And some fear that this could mark the beginning of a broader revival of kind of ideological education that could soon seep into schools and universities. And they fear that this program could be used to just kind of punish any individuals who are viewed as too pro-Western. Dmitry Dries, the deputy editor of the Kommersant Daily, is among those who are worried about this just because of the historical precedent. He said, quote, "All of this is reminiscent of a gradual return to the USSR." And this new political wing is very similar to the old political branch in the Soviet army, which indoctrinated troops into the principles of communism just to ensure total loyalty to the party. So if anyone was found to be disloyal to those communist principles, they would usually be sent to the gulags and sometimes, you know, never heard from again. So in light of that recent history, it is very sobering to see Putin reviving this part of the Soviet army just by creating this political branch.
Put this in context for us. What else Vladimir Putin has been doing to resurrect that Soviet era, and why this is important just from a prophetic standpoint?
Sure, yes. This is just the latest in a long list, really. We've spoken many times about that 2005 instance when Putin said the demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century, of the 20th century. So he took that very personally, and he has been working ever since to restore Russian power and prestige to its Soviet levels. So we've seen him resurrect the famous Hero of Socialist Labor Award. He resurrected the Soviet anthem as Russia's national anthem. He revived a Stalin era kind of a military prep public physical fitness program that kind of just makes all Russians feel like soldiers in training. And he resurrected a Soviet style law against dissent. In the first half of the show, we talked about his invasion of Georgia and Ukraine. You know, both of those were, they used to be part of the Soviet Union. So that shows that he's determined to even recreate the physical geography of the Soviet Union, to bring back those territories back under Russia's control. So it's clear that Putin is doing everything he can to reverse what he views as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about this in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And he just shows that in doing so, Putin is fulfilling specific Bible prophecies in Ezekiel 38, and several other passages. So if any listeners would like to understand the details of Putin's role in Bible prophecy and the ultimately inspiring truth that is tied to that, we'll have a link in our show notes to Mr. Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. Turkey's president has been increasing his control over his country substantially, taking on dictatorial powers. Yet it seems other nations don't seem particularly concerned. To learn about the latest here, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Germany announced this week that Erdogan would be visiting Germany, and not just a kind of any kind of visit, but they're rolling out the red carpet for him. It's a full state visit. So there'll be military honors, there'll be a state banquet, the works. And I think this is really quite remarkable because Erdogan is very, very unpopular within Germany. Like you said, he's a dictator. He's locked up journalists that have German citizens. There have been quite a lot of even just street protests against him personally over the years. Oh, sorry, I should say journalists that have German citizenship. not journalists that have German citizens and a hostage in their basement or something like that. And so because he's been doing that, you know, he's really unpopular, but still the government is bringing them over. And I think it just shows the importance that Germany places on that relationship, that they would risk so much, you know, risk going against popular opinion in that fashion. It's something we've seen throughout this almost crisis in German-Turkish relations over the last 2-3 years, where there have been strains in that relationship. There has been a lot of criticism, but all through that, they've kept the essentials going. Mm-hmm. You know, they've kept the essential arms trades going. They've kept doors open. Very famously, Sigmar Gabriel had Erdogan over to his personal home and served him tea and all of this kind of thing. So no matter how unpalatable Erdogan looks, Germany's just sold on that relationship.
And the alliance between Germany and Turkey is one that is pretty explicitly prophesied in the Bible.
That's right. And that's why I think this whole story has been fascinating to watch. Because, yeah, based on that prophecy, we've been saying all along, you know, that relationship is going to continue. Yes, there may be some cosmetic fallout as time goes on. You know, yes, there may be some of these, and we saw that, you know, Germany moved their military base, for example, from Incirlik in Turkey over to Jordan. Yes, there may be some friction, but fundamentally, this relationship is going to keep moving. And that's because, as you said, there are just very specific Bible prophecies about Germany and Turkey, or Edom, as it's known in the Bible. And it makes a lot of sense, because if you're a European power and you want to project power into the Middle East, you pretty much got to go through Turkey. Mm-hmm. If you're going to project power to any serious degree, because they're the land bridge between Europe and the Middle East. The Bible even talks about them in that term as a bridge or a crossroads. Mm-hmm. So geopolitically, it makes sense for them to continue that alliance. Prophetically, it makes sense for them to continue that alliance. And I wrote about this a year or two ago. We have an article called Pivotal Power, and that will take you through those prophecies. And show you just that strong relationship where the two of them are working together on joint projects like developing new tanks, all of the weapons that Turkey has that comes from Europe, and exactly where that alliance is leading. Because, as you said, this alliance is just dramatic, very specific proof of the reliability of Bible prophecy in the news that we see all around us.
You know, even knowing what we know about that prophecy and anticipating that alliance remaining strong despite the unpalatability of Erdogan and so on, it still raises the eyebrow to see Germany being willing to be that open in rolling out the red carpet for him. Nevertheless, that's what's going on. We appreciate that, Richard. A disturbing story hit this week about an Islamic terrorist threat in the U.S. within New Mexico. For this story, our last of the program today, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, a 3-year-old boy in Georgia went missing a couple years ago, and local authorities finally found the body at a compound in New Mexico. The compound was being run by Siraj Ibn Wahaj, a 39-year-old Islamic man who was training 11 children at the compound to act as suicide bombers in future Islamic terrorist attacks against the United States. The discovery was interesting is that the father of Wahaj, who had the same name as his son, is a very prominent imam in Brooklyn, New York, who was called as a character witness to one of the men who masterminded the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. He was the Wahaj Sr. had been investigated as one of the 72 suspects for that bombing, but not indicted. And now it's been revealed that his son, both his daughters, and many of his grandchildren were at this compound, which was, by all accounts, just like filthy, like living in like squalor and malnourishment, but learning how to shoot in preparation for using school shootings as a terrorist tactic. And so fortunately, like I said, authorities, because they were looking for this missing 3-year-old, discovered the cell, discovered the compound, shut it down, and there was no terrorist attacks carried out in this case, although in the 16 or so years since the 9/11 bombing, there have been 159 deaths and 502 injuries perpetrated by Islamic terrorists in 53 separate terrorist attacks, which is something we at the Trumpet keep a very close eye on, for one, just due to the national security threat, but even more significantly due to a prophecy in Leviticus 26, where that chapter, God lists all the blessings that come to a nation that obey his laws, and all the cursings that come to a nation that disobeys. And amongst the curses, as God said, he would appoint of you like terror and consumption. And terrorism in America comes in many forms. There's drug cartels, you've got gangs, you've got anarchists, you've got in left-wing environmental terrorists. But since those 9/11 World Trade Center bombings, one of the primary forms of terrorism that's just really been plaguing America is Islamic terrorism. And in this case, you have one of the people investigated for the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center with his children and his grandchildren continuing in that tradition.
All right. Well, thank you for that very much, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for the Trumpet Hour today. Visit the hub for Trumpet Hour on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
It's an honor to be here.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Benjamin Franklin: contentment makes poor men rich. Discontentment makes rich men poor. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.